Welcome to episode 185 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Bound for Glory Sunday, October 16th, 2011. I am the Solid Monster. We'll talk about Bound for Glory, a lot of TNA stuff in just a second. First things first, I want to thank everybody who has sent in positive feedback to episode 184. And for those of you who may have missed it and you think I'm skipping a number and wondering what happened to 184, 184 was an emergency sound off that I posted on late Tuesday night in light of one of the worst Raws that I've ever seen. Certainly, easily the worst Raw of the entire year. That atrocity from last Monday night, which I don't want to talk too much more about other than just to say Raw sucked. If you want to know my thoughts about Raw, all you got to do is go back, listen to episode 184, and just tell me if you disagree with me, because I find it impossible to believe that there could be a human being alive who saw that show. And if you didn't think it was the worst show you ever saw, that's fine. But I don't see how anybody could watch that show and think it was any good, and that it's going to do the company any good heading into Vengeance, which is their pay-per-view coming up next week. And that's right, they've got a pay-per-view that they're trying to promote that nobody's going to buy. So Raw sucked. Go back and listen to that if you haven't. And thanks to everybody who wrote in. A lot of very passionate feedback. A lot of people agreed with me. Some people were even harsher on the show than I was, which I find impossible to believe, but you would be amazed at the level of emotion that show. Hey, if nothing else, Raw caused people to feel something. They caused people to feel great anger and great frustration at their television show. And in light of this, I came across a very interesting job posting. I wanted to bring this to everybody's attention. WWE has put out a job posting. I don't know how long it's been up for, but I just came across it this week for the position of live event producer. And there's a reason I bring this up. And I'm going to read part of this to you. This is not the whole thing. But in part, this job posting reads as follows. WWE is an integrated media organization and recognized leader in global entertainment. WWE is committed to family-friendly PG content across all of its platforms, including television programming, pay-per-view, digital media, and publishing. So for the record, any people out there who think the end of PG is near, guess again. And anyway, it goes on a little bit. Now here's the part that really got under my skin. Quote, the live event producer will be responsible for the entire production of the live event, from carrying storyline throughout the show, adding creative and entertaining elements, directing the production manager regarding lighting, to meeting with producers regarding match outcomes. And here's the kicker. This position needs to be someone with on-the-road and live event experience and needs to have a bigger picture mentality. The live event producer needs to quickly develop an understanding of WWE creative, television production, and have relevant experience in live event production. Needs to have a bigger picture mentality. I have not had a bigger belly laugh than I did when I read that part of this job description. Bigger picture mentality? This from the company that has a CEO, a chairman, that changes his mind from the moment he sits on the toilet to the moment he leaves the restroom. Bigger picture mentality. Did you not see that show last Monday night? Whoever wrote this description, let me tell you, could not be any more full of shit. Well, I guess Hulk Hogan is probably full of more shit, and we'll get to him in a second. But I just couldn't believe that when I read that. Bigger picture mentality. We need to see the bigger picture here, folks. It's not about week to week. These people have a vision. They know exactly where they're going. Hell, they probably have their entire WrestleMania card mapped out right now. We just don't know it. Do you honestly believe that? I don't. I just, in light of what we saw last week, and quite frankly, a lot of the booking that we have seen over the last several weeks that has undone any goodwill WWE built up over the summer with the CM Punk storyline. And the CM Punk storyline for me peaked when he put the championship belt in his refrigerator. And actually, I shouldn't even say that. I should say when he stormed the panel at Comic-Con and confronted Triple H for the first time. To me, that's when everything peaked, because ever since then, it's been all downhill. The moment he came back on Raw, a week after he left, is when this downward spiral began. And WWE, all they have to do is look at Ring of Honor, of all places, for how this angle should have played itself out. Kevin Steen, Mr. Wrestling himself, Kevin Steen, a featured performer for many years now in ROH, he lost a match to El Generico at the end of last year. hope I have my timeline right on this. And basically, the idea is that he was gone from Ring of Honor, never to return again. And of course, I'm sure many people figured, okay, that's bullshit. And I believe at the time, the idea was that he was going to maybe heal up from some injuries or whatever the case may be, but he would eventually be back. But guess what? Steen was gone for months, and they've continued this angle where, over the last few months, Steen has made appearances at various Ring of Honor events, and he's posted videos, and he's threatened Jim Cornette. He wants to come back. He kind of invaded their last show here in New York City at the Manhattan Center. He does a lot of, and actually the way they handled that whole thing was just tremendously well done. On their television show last week, they have this thing where Nigel McGuinness, former wrestler who's now an announcer for Ring of Honor, goes up to the fans at one point during the show to kind of poll them on who they think is going to win the main event that week on TV. And they've been doing this, I mean, they've only had 3 or 4 shows so far, but Nigel, on last week's show, went up to somebody at ringside who was obviously a plant, I would have to expect, and the person took the mic, and before he could give his answer, he started chanting, you know, bring Steen back, bring Steen back, and of course Nigel was disgusted. He said, see what happens when you give somebody a live mic. It's little touches like that. They're playing the same angle WWE did with Punk, and they're doing it 10 times better than they are. And I know that WWE can't necessarily afford to keep CM Punk out for 6 months or for a year. I get that, but they botched this so badly, like they botched everything else that they touch. And it doesn't have to be that way. Punk was supposed to be special. And I feel great for the guy. The guy, if nothing else, has turned into a true main event performer, making, I'm sure, main event money. He's doing well in merchandise sales. He has upped his cred in WWE. And I think that's fantastic. But they could have done so much more with this storyline. And once they brought Triple H in, and just, it's been a downhill road from there. And last week's show was just an abomination. Now this week, all of a sudden, I don't want to spoil things. I ranted enough on the last show about Jim Ross, what they did to him, how he didn't know about being fired in advance. And essentially, they fired him. They got rid of him from the company, at least on television. And if you've read the Raw spoilers for the Mexico tapings that will be airing on Monday night, I really don't think this company knows what they're doing. I really don't. And that's scary. It really is scary because WWE is, for better or worse, the top dog in town. As WWE goes, so goes the rest of wrestling. Like it or not, even if Vince McMahon's product is not your cup of tea, they set the standard for how hot or cold professional wrestling is. If WWE is hot, TNA would be hot. Well, to some degree. Ring of Honor would be hot. The independents would be able to benefit from that. And when WWE is ice cold, so goes everything else. So I really do wish they would hire people that have a bigger picture mentality. But you could hire all those people in the world. It doesn't matter if the top man in your organization does not have that same vision. It just doesn't matter. Just a quick note that SmackDown is going live again on Tuesday, November 29th. They put a press release out, Sci-Fi did this past week, following the record-setting performance of Sci-Fi's first-ever Super SmackDown Live. That's what they're calling this thing. On August 30th, Sci-Fi and WWE announced this week that the next Super SmackDown Live special will air on Tuesday, November 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So, basically, they're doing this experiment again, and they may do another experiment even after this. They want to gauge how realistic those numbers were that first time, because that first live SmackDown did great numbers. And if they can have a repeat performance here, this may go a long way in convincing Sci-Fi to move the show permanently to Tuesday nights. So we'll see how that goes. One other WWE thing I want to mention here before we get to the TNA stuff, and it concerns Gail Kim. Gail Kim, of course, quit WWE several months ago. She was very frustrated on her lack of push and the lack of attention paid to the Divas division in the company. And so a couple of months ago, she was in a Divas Battle Royal. She eliminated herself from the Battle Royal. And almost nobody noticed. Some fans noticed, obviously. Apparently the people in the back didn't even notice. She went backstage, and before Raw was even over, she went up to Johnny Ace and basically said, "I quit." And WWE would not allow her to quit, meaning they wouldn't release her from her contract so she can go work elsewhere. So basically, she sat home for the remainder of her deal, and now she's all free and clear to say and do whatever she wants. And so she participated in a paid, on-demand shoot interview, which I find to be quite comical, actually, that people would actually pay $12.95 to listen to Gail Kim shoot on WWE. But I guess some people did. It was on the website WWNLive.com on Wednesday. And she had a couple of interesting things that she revealed during the course of this interview. So I just want to go through some of the key points from the interview here. So, for example, during the course of it, she said that the divas today are told that they're getting too physical and they're getting too good, which is an indicator that WWE apparently does not want the women to overshadow or upstage the male wrestlers. And I can believe that. In fact, I believe WWE probably does that or has done that in the past with some male wrestlers in the lower card. Can't have a mid-card guy going out there showing up the main eventers. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm not surprised at all to hear that they've done this with the divas. And in a way, it is kind of unfair to them because even myself, I'll review a Raw show and I'll talk about how goddamn awful, for example, Kelly is in a match with Rosa Mendez. Now, that might be a bad example because Rosa sucks. I mean, Rosa really is a terrible wrestler. And Kelly has improved a little bit, but she also, quite frankly, does not belong inside of a wrestling ring. But I'm sure some of these women are better than they come off as on TV, and it's unfair sometimes to criticize them. The problem is you can't tell the truly good workers anymore from the horrific ones. She complained that she had the opportunity to be in a documentary about about successful Korean people, and claims that WWE would not let her do it, which is WWE's prerogative, quite frankly. You're under contract to WWE, and they're very, very particular about letting their own wrestlers do movies or any sort of outside project. You know, when I interviewed George Napolitano, the great wrestling photographer and author back on episode 182, he even mentioned when we were talking about Montreal, for example, which stirred up quite a bit of controversy with certain people, and his views on Montreal, whether it was a work or not, and there are still people who believe that Montreal was a work. And George is not necessarily one of those people. He just put the theory out there that he knows WWE quite well, and Bret Hart had a camera guy backstage with full access doing a documentary about the last year of Bret's career, and he found it very odd that WWE would allow something like that because they're very, very particular about letting cameras backstage, about letting their talent do outside projects. So I have no problem with that. She, in my opinion, that's just sour grapes on her part. She said that winning the Knockouts title in TNA meant more than winning the Women's Championship in WWE because it wasn't just handed to her. She says that she was part of building the division, and that made it more special. And that's true. I mean, Gail Kim and Awesome Kong had, quite frankly, an awesome feud during the earlier days of TNA. They helped make that Knockouts division. The Knockouts division is quite frankly, not as strong as it used to be, but you can make the argument that the Knockouts division in TNA these days is better than the Divas division in WWE. Either way, women's wrestling gets crapped on. You know, they don't get the sort of attention, perhaps, that they deserve, and Gail was a very big part of making that division something special in TNA. She said that as far as she knows, she never knew of any ideas for her to work with Karma in WWE, which is just unbelievable to me. I mean, it seemed like a no-brainer when Awesome Kong signed with WWE that they could do something with her and Kim. You know, Gail Kim could either be her first feud. In fact, I think that would be the best idea for Gail Kim to be Kong's first feud. Kong would obviously go over. You're trying to build her up as a monster. Who better to work with Awesome Kong than Gail Kim based on their previous matches? You know that Kim is going to make her look like $1 million, and you build her up a little bit more until you put, you know, Karma in the ring with somebody like Beth Phoenix, who, according to Gail Kim in the interview, is the person that I guess they were planning on building Karma up for before she got all pregnant and stuff. On leaving TNA, she said that she was in contract negotiations and she was having some financial trouble. And basically the pay that TNA was offering was not enough. And TNA did not make enough of an effort to keep Kim, which I'm sure also hurt her feelings. I mean, she was a pretty important part of that organization. And for them not to go the extra mile with Gail Kim when they've brought tons of other people into the company over the last couple of years that, quite frankly, had no business even being on television, was a slap in the face. And basically, she didn't want to go back to WWE, but she felt she had no choice. And that's how that went. On re-signing with WWE, back then. Gail said that Johnny Ace told her that the creative team was so excited to have her back, and they had tons of ideas for her, which is quite comical. She says she was offered a training position down in FCW, but turned it down because she felt she had a lot to offer still in the ring. She said that every week there would be a new rule for Divas. For example, no kicking, no punching. She said it was very frustrating. WWE wanted more girliness in Diva matches. And if you don't believe that, look no further than what they've done to Beth Phoenix and Natalya. In terms of how they look, in terms of how they dress. I mean, when this whole Divas of Doom thing started, they were railing on all the other Barbie-looking type divas in the division, like Kelly Kelly and people like that. And yet, in the weeks that followed, you can easily tell that Beth and Natalya were dolling themselves up with more makeup and wearing more, quite frankly, girly outfits, and it just didn't make any sense. So I absolutely believe that to be the case. She said that she heard rumors the Daniel Bryan Bella Twins storyline ended because the network, according to her, thought it wasn't heading in a very PG direction. So that's when they brought Gail Kim in as the girlfriend to end the storyline. And she says she was actually ready to quit the company the day that she was revealed as Daniel Bryan's girlfriend, but she prolonged it because she was finally being used on television. And I just laughed when I heard that, and I just thought to myself, poor Daniel Bryan, what must he be thinking to hear this, that Gail Kim is told, hey, you're going to be revealed as Daniel Bryan's girlfriend, and she was ready to quit on that day. But the only reason she stuck around was because she was getting on TV. What? Oh, boy. This guy, ever since he won the briefcase, the Money in the Bank briefcase, he just can't catch a break. He loses on TV every week. And now Gail Kim says she's ready to quit because she'd rather quit the company than be Daniel Bryan's girlfriend. Just horrible, horrible stuff. She said that she felt slapped in the face and disrespected by a series of events. It goes back to the way that she eliminated herself in the Battle Royal. She knows some people think that it was a very unprofessional thing that she did, and perhaps it is, but she obviously had reached her boiling point with the company. And again, there were people backstage, even Johnny Ace, who didn't even realize that she had eliminated herself. But I guess the directive was for all the women to go out there and get out of the ring as quickly as possible. Because again, WWE does not give a shit about the Diva division. No matter what they say, no matter what they do, they really don't care. It's, we have to get these girls on TV so we can justify having them. But when you go out there, do one move, and come back out to the backstage area, they don't care. They really don't care. So those are pretty much the key points from the interview. There was more to it. If you want to listen to it, I guess you can go to WWNLive.com. I guess you're going to have to pay for it. Why anybody, again, would want to pay money, let alone $12.95, to listen to Gail Kim shoot on WWE is beyond me. But hey, if that's what you're interested in, you can get the entire shoot on demand right now if you go to that website. Let's talk about TNA, shall we? This is kind of a big day for TNA. I'm sure by the time people listen to this show, Bound for Glory will be in the books. But there was other news that came out this week. TNA has obviously made some moves recently. I talked about the fact that Vince Russo is no longer the head of the TNA creative team. He is still on the creative team. He is still employed by TNA, which is a no-no. But Bruce Pritchard has essentially moved into the role of being the head creative person, in that he kind of oversees the entire creative process. He'll help dictate the direction of the storylines that you see on Impact from week to week. But Vince Russo and Matt Conway are still the two people writing the television shows. So I don't necessarily know that a lot is going to change. I guess we'll see. But they made another interesting creative hire this week. They hired Dave Lagana, former writer for WWE. He also worked for quite a while with Ring of Honor and helping put together their old TV show on HDNet. And TNA has picked him up. He noted on his official website, Lagana did, that his new title is Director of Creative Writing with TNA Wrestling. Now, when I first heard this, I thought, wow, this is great. You know, this is a step in the right direction. Dave Lagana, after all, is one of the people, supposedly, that Paul Heyman had planned to bring into TNA with him when he was very, very close to agreeing to a deal with the company to come in and just change everything up. When Heyman was in negotiations with Dixie Carter, Lagana, along with Gabe Sapolsky, who was kind of an understudy to Heyman in the old days of ECW, and then, of course, Sapolsky was the head guy in Ring of Honor from the company's inception until he was ousted from power. And the fact that Heyman was planning on bringing Lagana in with him is enough of an indicator to me that there's something to this guy. This guy has some sort of talent. if somebody like Paul Heyman saw enough in him to want to bring him over to TNA. So TNA picked him up. I read the description of his title, and I thought, this is another positive step for a company that had been on the brink of the point of no return, quite frankly. And then you read a little bit deeper into what Lagan is going to be doing for the company, and I'm a little less optimistic. He wrote that his duties will be to focus solely on the development of new wrestling shows beyond the Impact Wrestling series. So, in fact, Lagana will not be working on the Impact Wrestling show, but rather a new project in India that TNA is launching later this year. And apparently he may also have some involvement in the All Wheels Wrestling thing that TNA had done a taping back in June for this thing called All Wheels Wrestling. They're trying to merge the pro wrestling audience with the NASCAR audience. I guess they feel there's a lot of overlap there, which I don't see it, but perhaps there is. And they had tapings for this thing called All Wheels Wrestling. I don't think it's been picked up yet. I believe the hope was that Speed Network would pick it up. It hasn't happened. And if they do additional tapings for that brand, I guess Lagana may also have a hand in that as well. I find it incredibly bizarre that TNA, who has had maybe a couple of good weeks of TV shows. I admit I have not seen too much of Impact over the last couple of weeks, but I've heard from people who have said in some cases the show is a lot better. Some people say it's complete bullshit. The show is no better than it was 6 months ago. And the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, in that TNA has started to do certain things right. I've heard that the build-up to the Kurt Angle-Bobby Roode match at the pay-per-view tonight has been pretty outstanding compared to a lot of the other things TNA has been doing. They've been building Bobby Roode up very nicely. Hulk Hogan hasn't. We'll get to that in a second. But I just find it incredible that they're putting all this energy on other wrestling brands at the expense of focusing on their core wrestling brand. I mean, TNA Wrestling is what you see on Spike every Thursday night. And they live and die by the ratings, and that show has to do well. Because if Spike ever pulls the plug, TNA can start all these other brands that they want to. TNA dies without television. WWE dies without television, although they can stay afloat a little bit longer than TNA can. And soon enough, they're going to have their own network, so they won't have to worry about that. But TNA needs to focus on their main brand and stop worrying about All Wheels Wrestling, and let's start a wrestling organization in India. And let's go up to the North fucking Pole, and we'll start a wrestling organization up there too, called Ice Warriors or something like that. I mean, they got to stop worrying about stuff like that and get their own house in order. But that's just my view. So anyway, Lagana is not going to have any sort of involvement directly at all in the Impact brand. Now, could that change? Sure. I mean, he's under contract to them. Maybe 6 months or a year from now, they decide to bring him onto the creative team on Impact. The fact that they now have him under contract, I guess, is a positive. But again, if he's not going to have a hand in what you're seeing on television every week, then I don't see why any of us, unless we live in India, and we have a lot of people who listen to this podcast I know from India, and perhaps that's something for you guys to be excited about. But in all honesty, it doesn't really instill a lot of confidence in me. And as far as this project, again, it's supposedly going to be completely separate from TNA in terms of the talents, in terms of the creative. They brought other people in as well. In fact, Dutch Mantel, who once worked for TNA and was fired many years ago, which is what was believed to be at the time a power struggle. There was a lot of stuff going on at the time with Jeff Jarrett, who lost power in TNA, and Dutch Mantel was always a Jeff Jarrett ally. And so he... A lot of people think Mantel probably took a bullet for Jeff Jarrett. Ironically, Jarrett is directly involved with this New India project, and so, lo and behold, Dutch Mantel is back. So, they're really bringing some talent and some firepower in on this thing. It'll be interesting, if nothing else, to see how this all plays out. Now, let's talk about Bound for Glory, shall we? Jeff Hardy is going to be on the pay-per-view tonight in some capacity. He probably will be on there to do something with Jeff Jarrett. They've been going back and forth now, in the recent weeks. Hardy, of course, is now out of jail. He served his 10 days in jail, stemming from his plea agreement on drug charges in North Carolina. He voluntarily entered jail back on October 3rd, and then on Thursday, upon his release, he tweeted, "Hail Freedom!" Rest of the finalized Bound for Glory card. Mexican America and Ink Inc. are going to have a tag team title match that apparently will not air on the pay-per-view. The match is going to air as part of a live 30-minute pre-show that is going to be shown on the official Impact Wrestling Facebook page. You can go to facebook.com/impactwrestling to see that. Winter, Mickey James, Velvet Sky, Madison Rain in a four-way for the Knockouts title. Samoa Joe, Crimson, and Matt Morgan in a triple threat match. Austin Aries will defend the X Division Championship against Brian Kendrick. Rob Van Dam and Jerry Lynn will do battle in a Full Metal Mayhem match. Why? I don't know. AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels in an I Quit match. Mr. Anderson and Bully Ray in a Falls Count Anywhere match. It'll be interesting to see what kind of reception Bully Ray gets, being that this pay-per-view is not in Orlando. It is actually in Philadelphia, the former home of ECW. Hulk Hogan and Sting will have a fight for control of the company. And Kurt Angle will defend his TNA World Heavyweight Championship in the main event against Bobby Roode. And this is going to be a make-or-break match for Bobby Roode. Quite frankly, I cannot see any outcome here making sense other than Bobby Roode winning the championship. You know, they've done a very good job, apparently, of building him up and building him up. He's a talented guy. You know, he's going to be a world champion at some point very soon. As will James Storm, some people believe. And this is their WrestleMania, supposedly. This is the WrestleMania of TNA is what they're calling it. And it's the only outcome here that, quite frankly, makes sense without doing damage to the company. I don't see how Kurt Angle can beat Bobby Roode without hurting Bobby Roode. And speaking of Bobby Roode, this brings me to Hulk Hogan. Oh, Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan made the media rounds this week. He actually went around to the Howard Stern Show, ESPN. He was on Fox News Channel. He was on a couple of radio shows. And in most, not all, but most of those interviews, he mentioned TNA. The problem is that in many cases, he would talk about his match with Sting, but he never actually mentioned the TNA initials. He did in some interviews, but not all of them. That's kind of an important thing because, again, TNA is the number two promotion in the country. When people think of wrestling, they think of Vince McMahon. They think WWE. In fact, they probably still think WWF. A lot of them don't even know that it hasn't been WWF for almost a decade now. And it's very, very important to establish the TNA name, the TNA brand. So it's not enough for Hogan to go on these shows and just say, yeah, I'm going to be wrestling this Sunday and I've got a match with Sting, who, by the way, is a wrestler, not the music artist, not the musician. But for him not to mention TNA or Impact Wrestling in some of these interviews, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of doing media for TNA in the first place. I mean, people probably think that WWE has a pay-per-view coming up this weekend and Hulk Hogan is fighting Sting. Doesn't really do them any good. But the bigger issue here were comments that Hogan made about Bobby Roode. And he was on a Sirius satellite radio show, the Busted Open show, on Friday. And this is what he said. These are the comments that he said about Bobby Roode. Okay, some of the comments anyway. He said, he's not ready. He's not the next guy. They might think he is. Dixie Carter might think he is. The whole world might think he is. He's not the next guy. If I had to bet money on anybody and really be serious about betting money on anybody, I'd say Jeff Hardy is the next guy if he keeps his act together. That's what you got to have, man. This is much more than being a wrestler. This is crossing barriers, medias, you know, media barriers and entertainment barriers of all kinds. Getting your character down verbally has 90% to do with getting over. I just have a very strong feeling Kurt Angle's going to clean his clock performance-wise and carry the match and basically remain the champion. He's training for the Olympics. He's had some ups and downs. And I think this is not going to be a down moment for Kurt Angle, so I'm betting the farm on him. Now, when I first read these comments, I was not offended by them in the least. I thought, okay, well, Hulk Hogan is in character. Okay, Hulk Hogan is trying to maintain kayfabe. He is a heel in TNA. You know, he's part of Immortal. Why would Hulk Hogan endorse Bobby Roode over Kurt Angle? It kind of makes sense for him to say that Kurt Angle is going to retain his title and Kurt Angle is going to clean his clock, even though some of the terminology he used about him not being ready and all this stuff, it made me a little uneasy, but I thought, it's okay, he's in character. And then I continued on here in reading the transcript and then listening to the audio a little bit later on, and he had this to say about James Storm, Bobby Roode's tag team partner. He says, I'd go with James Storm all day long. Mainstream, brother, cowboy hat, beer drinking, middle America, NASCAR, Walmart, country western. I mean, all day long. It's a no-brainer. That's me. That's my opinion. So, I mean, Bobby Roode's a tremendous athlete. I would change. I'd build him from Venice Beach, California, or Omaha, Nebraska, instead of, I don't know, Canada, eh? I love him to death. He's a great kid. When he looked down at me from the ring and we had an argument one day, and I think he's talking about Bobby Roode here. And Bobby Roode said, what the hell have you ever done? I said, man, this guy would be a great heel. But yeah, he's got a lot of potential. But if you ask me to choose who to run with, and you gave me those two choices, my opinion would be James Storm. When I read that, I could not believe what I was reading. Now, let me just say this, because I see some people on Facebook and other places saying, Hulk Hogan said nothing wrong. I mean, hell, Hulk Hogan endorsed James Storm. And you know what? That's fine. The fact that Hulk Hogan endorsed James Storm is great. I got no problem if he wants to get behind James Storm and get on the James Storm bandwagon. But here's the thing. Okay? Here's the thing. A minute ago, I'm reading this, and I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, well, he's in character. He's basically burying Bobby Roode 6 feet under, okay? This guy, whether you like it or not, is the young guy that TNA has chosen to be the next big thing. And I have a feeling they're going to put the championship on him at Bound for Glory. If they know what's good for them, they will. I hope they don't do some bullshit where James Storm goes heel on Bobby Roode and cost him the title. But the point is that TNA made their choice a long time ago. From the moment this whole Bound for Glory series was dreamt up, and they've been working on this for months and months, Bobby Roode was the chosen son, okay? And he's a talented guy, and I think they made a good choice. Now, would I have gone with James Storm over Bobby Roode? I could go either way. James Storm is a very entertaining, very charismatic guy. He's a good wrestler. James Storm also, in my opinion, is somebody who, in the very near future, can and probably will hold a world championship. I mean, this makes Beer Money one of the most successful teams in the last 10 years in wrestling, because you've got not one but two members of the team, both members of the team, in fact, who can branch off as successful single stars and be a world champion one day. That's pretty impressive. But for Hulk Hogan to go on the radio just a couple of days in advance of TNA's biggest pay-per-view of the year, okay, they're trying to get as many people as possible to purchase Bound for Glory. They're trying to push Bobby Roode to the moon. They're putting him in the main event. Okay, they're going to strap the rocket to his back, and they're going to try to launch him into the stratosphere. And you've got Hulk Hogan, the face of your company, for better or worse, going on the radio talking about, this guy's not the one, he ain't ready. James Storm, there's a guy we could get behind. If you gave me the choice, I'd pick James Storm over the guy that we're promoting in our pay-per-view main event. How could Hogan possibly think that that's a good idea? I mean, really, you can't make the argument that, again, he's in character. He's not in character, because one second he's bashing the babyface and throwing his support behind the heel, Kurt Angle, and a minute later he's endorsing another babyface, which just tells me that these comments were not in character. This is how he really feels, and that's fine. Hulk Hogan is entitled to that opinion. Some people would argue the same way, that perhaps James Storm should have been the one to get the shot. And maybe he would have been. I don't know. I mean, James Storm suffered, I believe, a shoulder injury, a separated shoulder not too long ago. He wasn't able to really wrestle that much, even though he really didn't take any time off. Perhaps the injury had something to do with that and threw a monkey wrench into their plans. But not really. I mean, they've been building Bobby Roode up for a long time now. And for him to go on the radio and again, the face of TNA, trying to put this guy over and make people want to buy the pay-per-view. He's going out there saying, look, me and Sting are having a fight. We're not the main event. Kurt Angle and Bobby Roode is the main event. Me and Sting, we're just the icing on the cake. You want people to spend money on this show. You want to make Bobby Roode out to be a big deal, and you're going on the radio and not in character telling people he's not ready? Are you fucking mad? What is wrong with you? Why would you do something like that? Every time Hulk Hogan goes out there and he gets a mainstream interview, and he got a lot of them this week, okay, that's why TNA loves Hulk Hogan, because he opens up a lot of doors for them, at least in their minds, and he's got access to the mainstream media. He can go out there and he can make people aware of the fact that TNA wrestling is out there, and it's the number one brand. And it doesn't mean a goddamn thing when Hulk Hogan goes out there and either doesn't mention TNA by name, or puts down the young guys that they're trying to push and they're trying to promote and they're putting in the headlining spot on their pay-per-views, and he is just burying them 6 feet under because he thinks, this guy's not ready, I would have gone with this guy. It's just ridiculous. And then to continue to make this point that he's made before about Jeff Hardy. Yes, Jeff Hardy is also very charismatic, and Jeff Hardy has a lot of fans. But guess what? Jeff Hardy fucked his own career up. WWE gave Jeff Hardy the opportunity to be a megastar, and he was. For a period of time, Jeff Hardy was the most popular wrestler in this country, if not the world, based on Google searches and all these different statistics that they would keep track of and merchandise and all that stuff. Jeff Hardy was number one because he had a unique look to him, and he's got some fanatical fans. Say what you want to about the Hardy Boys, but they both have very, very loyal fans out there that will follow them through thick and thin, okay? And that's a plus. That's a positive if you're a wrestling promoter. But again, Jeff Hardy had his own demons. And maybe he still does, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's on the straight and narrow now. But Jeff Hardy now is in his mid-30s or approaching his mid-30s. He's had a lot of injuries. Okay, he's not quite what he used to be. I don't think anybody would disagree with that statement, that Jeff Hardy in the ring and all that is not what he used to be. And part of that is age, and part of that is also what he's done to his body. And Hulk Hogan is still going out there saying, well, I think Jeff Hardy, he could be the guy if he can get his head on straight. And again, I'm not disagreeing with that sentiment, but you got to stop going out there and pushing Jeff Hardy and burying Bobby Roode. Think of the message that this is sending. Jeff Hardy just got done serving 10 days in jail on drug charges. Jeff Hardy is the same man that in February of this year, less than a year ago, was in the main event of your pay-per-view, and he embarrassed your company. Just fucking embarrassed your company like nobody else has ever done, except maybe Vince Russo, okay, who's done plenty to embarrass TNA over the years. But this man went out there and made a fucking mockery of your company. And you allowed it. You allowed him to go out there. You allowed it to happen. TNA was as responsible for that as Jeff Hardy was, if not more so. And the guy was off television for months. He came back. He got sentenced. He went to jail. He's paid the price. He's paid his penance. True. I agree with that. But you know what? He doesn't deserve to be promoted in interviews like this by Hulk Hogan. He wants to work his way back up. Let him do that. Let him build some goodwill in TNA. Let him show that he cares. Let him show that the company can get behind him. Let a couple of months go by. Let a year go by. And then maybe everybody can get back on the Jeff Hardy train. But until that happens, I don't want to hear people like Hulk Hogan going out there and saying, Bobby Roode is not ready, Bobby Roode sucks. If it were up to me, I'd go with Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy's the man. Jeff Hardy is not the man. Jeff Hardy used to be the man. Jeff Hardy could be the man, but Jeff Hardy is not the man. He doesn't deserve to be the man. It angered me to hear him say that, and I've heard him in other interviews try to build up Jeff Hardy, and it's just complete bullshit. After everything that he has put that company through, and you're going to go out there and still endorse this guy? What a joke. And then Hogan goes on WFAN, a radio station here in New York. He was on the Boomer and Carton show. And this wasn't so much offensive as it was just funny. Because we all know Hogan speaks his own language. It's called Hoganese. John Cena also speaks that language. And basically, anything that comes out of Hulk Hogan's mouth, don't believe it. That's basically the message. Actually, there's a lot of guys like that. Kurt Angle has become like that. So Hogan did this interview. He talked about WrestleMania 3 and peddled some more bullshit and says that the movie The Wrestler that had Mickey Rourke in it, he said before that he was offered the role and stuff like that. But anyway, the whopper in this interview, the knee-slapping funny moment in this interview came when the host asked him if he would have had any interest in going into MMA if the sport was as popular when he was younger as it is today. And Hogan said that he had some experience since he wrestled in Japan. He said there were a lot of pride fighters that he faced when he wrestled there around 1977, and he said that he never knew whether he was getting in the ring with a shooter or not. And he said he also thinks that UFC, he thinks UFC just bought Pride. Yes, UFC did buy Pride. They didn't just buy Pride. But this notion that Hogan competed against Pride fighters in the 1970s, when the Pride organization was not even created, it wasn't even founded until 1997, is just, it is what it is. It's Hulk Hogan. You know, you get what you get when you interview Hulk Hogan. And it's a shame, too, because, you know, Hogan is the kind of guy who's been in the business for, like, 90 years now. And one of the biggest stars in the history of pro wrestling. Nobody can deny that. And he probably would have a lot of great stories to tell and all this. And every time he opens his mouth, you just have to automatically assume that it is complete and utter bullshit. It's a shame, really, because I think he would have a lot of very interesting stories, and he knows a lot of things, I'm sure, that he hasn't told us. But anyway, I think the only time Hogan has ever probably told the truth is when he was under oath back in 94 during the Vince McMahon steroid trial. And that's an interesting thing, by the way, if you go online to read up all about the trial and to read Hogan's testimony. It may well be the only time in his entire professional life since he became a big star that Hogan has ever told the truth, and that was only because he had to. Although, if I remember correctly, I think Hogan may have been granted immunity before the trial. But anyway, this was bullshit. Hogan did not wrestle Pride Fighters because Pride Fighters didn't exist in the 1970s. Unless he's talking about Pride Fighters, you know, 20 years before they joined Pride, which he's not. So he's full of shit. Ring of Honor, episode number 3 from last week. I finally had an opportunity to sit down and watch it yesterday. I've been waiting to talk about Ring of Honor because after that shit show on Monday night and even this TNA stuff that just made my blood boil, I could always rely on ROH to bring my blood pressure down a little bit. It was another good show. Not outstanding or anything like that, but it was a fine professional wrestling show. They advanced certain characters, and they had an absolutely great main event. So, in some ways, it actually was quite a spectacular show. Took a couple of notes here. I'm not going to go through the entire show, just some of the things that stood out to me. I mentioned the Kevin Steen point earlier, which I wanted to make mention of that, the fact that they're doing the CM Punk angle better than WWE's doing it. On this show, they also featured a star by the name of Tommaso Ciampa, and I had very little exposure to Ciampa before. I was aware of him, but I never really watched him work. I didn't know too much about him, and they had one of these spotlight features that they've been doing on this show where they kind of take a performer and they put together a little package so you get to learn a little bit more about who he is and where he's from and all that kind of stuff. And Ciampa is part of the heel faction in ROH led by Prince Nana, known as the Embassy. And Prince Nana, I mean, he is a character right out of the 1970s or the 1980s pro wrestling, like the old Grand Wizard. Such an outlandish gimmick, you know. He's like the son of a prince or a king, I guess, or whatever. He doesn't deal in money, you see. He's got gold coins. So anyway, Ciampa had a match on this show with Andy Right Leg Ridge, who is the classic underdog. And it was basically a squash right out of the old WWF Superstars days. Only, not really, because Ridge got a lot more offense in this match, I think, than most jobbers used to in those enhancement matches. But for all intents and purposes, I mean, it was intended to be a showcase for Ciampa. And I was impressed by this guy, and I was impressed by this whole match. This is what's missing from pro wrestling these days. I understand that it's 2011. You can't necessarily, I mean, you know, you don't want to fill an entire episode of Raw or SmackDown with matches like this, but there's no reason on a 2-hour show, and this is a 1-hour show, but if you're WWE and you've got 2 hours of TV to kill, and clearly they don't know what the hell they're doing from week to week, they don't even know how to fill their television show, so they'll just put stuff out there. You mean to tell me that you can't have a match like the match that Ciampa had on this show with Andy Right Leg Ridge, where here's a guy that we want to try to get over, we just brought him up from FCW, and so instead of putting him in the ring with one of our upper mid-card talents, you know, in his first match, which he probably then won't even win, so automatically he looks like a loser right from his debut, why don't we put him in the ring with somebody like an Andy Ridge, whoever the equivalent would be in WWE, whether it's Santino, or maybe they just bring in an enhancement guy that isn't one of your usual Raw performers, and put him in the ring and give him a lot of offense and let him show people what he's made of. Let him show off some of his cool moves. That's the thing that struck me in this match. Ciampa is a guy, you know, you look at him, he looks like a big muscle head. Not on a Mason Ryan scale. You know, but he's in good shape, big guy, but he's a very good worker. I was very impressed by what I saw in this match. He beat the hell out of Ridge. Ridge kept coming back. They call him Right Leg, not because he's a gimp or anything, but because his right leg is very dangerous. He's known for his kicks. And again, he got a lot of offense in this match. And then at the end, he was down. Ridge was down in the corner, and Ciampa did the running knee spot that we see a lot of guys do. You know, we see Samoa Joe did it, and Mick Foley used to do it when he was, you know, Cactus Jack and Mankind. And he just did like 5 or 6 knees consecutively, one after the other after the other. I mean, he was just brutalizing this poor kid. And he picks him up, and he's going to give him a powerbomb. Now, I wasn't aware of what Ciampa's finisher was, so I just assumed, all right, he's probably going to give him maybe a sit-out powerbomb or something like that. He picked the guy up. He was kind of holding him. You know, he grabbed his back. He's got him up in the air in a powerbomb position. And he delivers a powerbomb on his knees. Basically, you know, Ciampa falls back, puts his own knees up, so Ridge just comes crashing down on his knees for like a backcracker type move. Pinned him 1-2-3. Very impressive finisher. And coming out of this match, I knew very little, if anything, about this Tommaso Ciampa, and now I know a lot about him, and quite frankly, he impressed the hell out of me. Guess what? Mission accomplished. This is not complicated. This is what wrestling should be. This is very easy stuff. So I enjoyed that. They had 2 video packages again. They were promoting the main event. The main event on the show was a world championship match. Now, remember, last week we saw a title change. We saw Jay Lethal, who TNA had released earlier in the year for reasons that still escape me. Doesn't make any sense. Lethal beat El Generico to become the Ring of Honor television champion in a great TV main event. I really loved that match. And so this week we had a world championship match. And so you know, a lot of people probably saw the show last week. They saw a title change hands, and so they figured, hey, not out of the realm of possibility that the world title could change hands this week. And they built them up. You know, again, Roderick Strong is a great wrestler. I said a week or two ago, I was reviewing the show. They had comments from him, and I said I wasn't really impressed by his promo. He seemed very too much, almost like he was playing a character. Maybe that's the way he is in real life. I find that hard to believe. He just came off as this really kind of goofy, very cocky, kind of frat boy type character. And I don't know. I never really looked at Roderick Strong that way, so I didn't really enjoy the promo. And this one was even worse, as far as I'm concerned. Just totally cartoonish. And yet, his promo ends, and we get now a package on his opponent, the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion, Davey Richards, which was just tremendous. Just the complete and polar opposite of what we had just seen with the Roderick Strong promo, which just seemed so over the top and so ridiculous. And yet, the Davey Richards segment, talking about his grandparents and how he won his first title in Western Canada and then got the phone call that his grandfather, who was suffering from cancer, that his lung had collapsed. And so he was, you know, racing home on the road, falling asleep because he was so tired, it was so late, racing home to see him so he could thank him for raising him, because he was raised by his grandparents. You know, his parents, I don't know what happened to his parents. It doesn't sound like they died. It just sounds like they, for all intents and purposes, they deserted him. And so his grandparents obviously meant a lot to him. And this was a great, great segment. I mean, if you were not a fan of Davey Richards, you cannot come away from that segment not liking the guy or not understanding him more, why he's so intense. You know, he comes off as such a serious guy, and he scares me a little bit just because you look at Davey Richards, he's a short guy, he's built, he's very intense, very stiff, and he's almost like a carbon copy when you look at him work, and you just look at him, period. Almost like a carbon copy of the Dynamite Kid or Chris Benoit. Two stories that in wrestling did not have a very happy ending, and I certainly hope, I don't know him personally, I hope Davey is not that kind of person, but he just comes off as being a very intense personality. And so we had our main event. It was Davey Richards and Roderick Strong for the World Heavyweight Championship. Roddy comes to the ring with his life intervention expert, Truth Martini, who would interfere a little bit later on in the match, and didn't really play into the finish, though. This was just a one-on-one, just a brutal match between two guys that were just beating the crap out of each other with chops and kicks and punches and boots to the face. And, you know, it was a great main event. If I had to criticize, I would say that the one thing that I came away from this match not liking was the fact that I understand that they're very well-versed in kicking and chopping the hell out of people. I get that. And a typical Ring of Honor main event, you expect to have a certain number of near falls. People kick out of everything over and over and over again. And if I had to criticize, too many kicks. After a while, I was getting a headache. There were so many kicks being thrown around. And too many kick-outs. It's fine to have near falls. You know, they could be exciting if they're well-placed and everything like that. But again, the one thing with Ring of Honor main events, and this is not for every Ring of Honor main event, but I've seen it a lot at the shows that I used to go to and even on TV now, they tend to overdo it on that type of stuff. It's like you get to a point where it's like, okay, how the hell would this guy kick out of that? You know what I mean? And it just gets to be a little redundant after a while. I felt like there was a little bit too much of that in this match. But again, it's a minor criticism because I really love this match. It was a great match. We got a clean finish. Davey Richards retained his championship. And if there's one other criticism, I would say within 5 seconds of Davey Richards winning the championship, they went off the air. It was like he won. They almost immediately cut away and said, all right, we'll see you next week. And I guess they were running low on TV time. They actually were teasing towards the end of this match. They were saying, which brought me back to the old days, the original days of Monday Night Raw, when you used to have a TV main event and the credits would come on, not the credits, but the copyright box would pop up on the bottom of the screen and they'd have to go off the air. And they would actually go off the air in the middle of their final match. And sometimes when they would come back on TV the following week, they would bring you the highlights of that match. And sometimes they wouldn't, by the way, which used to piss me off. WWE would go off the air and they'd say, oh, we'll bring you highlights of this match next week, and then they wouldn't. And they did that here. They said, oh, we're running perilously low on TV time, and if we have to go off the air, we promise we'll bring you highlights of this match next week. And, of course, they didn't go off the air in the middle of the match, but I just thought, wow, they just literally, within 5 seconds, they just cut away when the match ended. You didn't really have an opportunity to absorb anything, And that was that. That was ROH last week. Another fine show. And I will say, I actually enjoy the commentary of Kevin Kelly. Nigel McGuinness, he's okay. I think, again, over time, the two of them as an announced team will gel better. But it's far and away better than any announced team anywhere else in wrestling. And that includes TNA, and it goddamn sure includes WWE. And actually, for the Tommaso Ciampa squash match on this show, Nigel bowed out, and Steve Corino joined Kevin Kelly on commentary. And I enjoyed that commentary, too. I thought Steve Corino also worked very well with Kevin Kelly. It was just refreshing to see two wrestling announcers who, you've got to have chemistry, you've got to have a sense of humor, you can crack jokes and stuff like that, but they actually call the action. You know, it feels like you're watching a wrestling show. It feels like you're watching almost like a sporting event in that they're actually doing play-by-play. And as Jim Ross said on his Twitter, he went on a Twitter tangent, I think, overnight, and one of the comments he made was about WWE and how play-by-play is dead. And in that company, it is, because they don't do play-by-play. They tell stories. And unfortunately for us, most of the time, those stories are shitty. Anyway, good show, thumbs up, and I very much look forward to seeing the next episode, which I believe is already floating around in some places. It aired yesterday, so hopefully I'll be able to see it sometime later in the week. Now, I've got one more review here to get to on the Sound Off this week, and before I do this, let me just say that, again, for those of you who may not be aware, I'm going to be doing a new segment, maybe not on the show every single week, maybe it's every other week, maybe it's once a month, I haven't figured that out yet, but you submit to me a classic wrestling match, a classic, whether it's WWE or NWA or ROH, whatever it may be, and your definition of classic is up to you, classically good, classically bad, whatever it is, that you would like to see me review and analyze, pick apart, give the backstory behind, whatever the case may be, here on the Sound Off. And so send in your match suggestions. I've gotten a whole bunch already, so I'm already a little bit backlogged, to be honest with you. But I'm going to keep a running list, and I will pick the best ones. And starting very soon, possibly as early as next week, it's going to be starting shortly, I will be doing that. I haven't come up with a name for this yet. I've had the suggestion of Match Anatomy, which actually the original person who actually suggested the idea to me came up with that as a title. I've gotten some other suggestions. So anything that you have, email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com, and I will be sure to take that under consideration. But what I'm going to do here, I watched an old-school Coliseum video called Paul Bearer's Hits from the Crypt. This, I believe, is still airing, actually, on WWE Classics On Demand, so those of you who have access to the channel can subscribe. On my cable provider here in New York, it is, I think, $6.99 a month. I think it might be. It's a steal, as far as I'm concerned. They don't give you a lot of content. It's rotating, I think, 20 hours of fresh content each month, or every 2 weeks, actually, some of the content revolves. But if you're a fan of classic wrestling, if you're not a fan of what you see on TV these days, and you want to watch some old-school primetime wrestling, or, you know, NWA wrestling, the original ECW, go back to the Monday Night Wars, they actually will also show current WWE pay-per-views, I believe, on a three-month delay. Maybe it's a little bit more than that, because actually right now they're showing Over the Limit from May, so that's a little bit more than 3 months. But it's totally worth it. It's a steal, and if you have access to it, I highly recommend that you sign up and at least sample it. And this month, in one of the sections on the menu, I saw Paul Bearer's Hits from the Crypt, and I was intrigued because I've seen a lot of the old WWF Coliseum video releases. I have not seen all of them, but I've seen many of them, and this is one that escaped me. This is one that came out, I believe, in 1994, maybe 95, although the matches on here are pretty much all but one were taped in 1994. The main event, I guess you would call it, the last match on this tape, was an Undertaker Crush match, which I believe was from November of 1993, so that was the only 93 match. And the announced team varied from match to match. In some cases, it was Vince McMahon and Gorilla Monsoon. It was Gorilla Monsoon and Stan Lane, sweet Stan Lane, for most of the matches. And I think the last match was Gorilla Monsoon and Johnny Polo, who you may know better as Raven, who just annoyed the fuck out of me back in the day when he used to do commentary. But yet, I don't know, I was kind of intrigued by the two of them on this particular tape as a announced tandem. So I just want to give a quick review. I just thought it would be fun since I spent the time to watch it. Give my thoughts on just some of the matches on here. So I'm just going to go through the list really quick. We had a Lex Luger-Jeff Jarrett match. Again, mind you, this is in 1994, and this match would have been taped shortly after WrestleMania 10, when Lex Luger was dead after SummerSlam 93, but if he had any life left in him as a character, as a babyface in WWF, it was pretty much dead, completely dead, after WrestleMania 10. So he was still the All-American. He had a match with Jeff Jarrett, who was wearing something that looks like it came from the closet of Brutus the Barber Beefcake, just a horrendous outfit. And it was pretty much a standard wrestling match. Luger won with the rack at the end. It was fine for what it was. My favorite match on the entire tape was the second match, which was taped about a month and a half or so before their epic ladder match at WrestleMania 10. It was a straight singles match. I don't know if it was for the Intercontinental Championship or not. I don't know if they ever really made mention of that. But Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon. And in Shawn Michaels' corner was his big bodyguard Diesel. And I don't know that I've ever seen a bad Shawn Michaels-Razor Ramon match. Shawn Michaels and Scott Hall had tremendous chemistry whenever they worked together. And they happened to have two ladder matches that were amazing. But even when they would have a straight singles match, and they had at least one or two on Raw back in the day. In fact, if I remember correctly, Shawn Michaels, he didn't wrestle for a good chunk of 1994 after WrestleMania. He was pretty much relegated just to being a manager for Diesel, I think because he was just healing up injuries and just needed some time off. So he was still on TV, but he wasn't wrestling. And I think his first match wrestling in many months would have been in July of 94. And I think his first match back was against Razor. And I just remember they had an amazing match. I mean, they worked so well together. And this match was no exception. Just a great match. It went to what I believe may have been a count-out finish. And it looked like it was headed for disappointment, and then the match continued. And I'm trying to think now. I think Razor won the match. But the point is, if you get a chance to see this tape, of all the matches on here, this is probably number one, maybe number two. And I'll tell you why in a second. But this was a great match. Bam Bam Bigelow and Mabel. I did watch this. In fact, I didn't fast forward through anything on this tape on demand here. I watched the entire thing from start to finish over the course of 2 or 3 days. But I did watch Bam Bam Bigelow and Mabel, and I will say this much. I have seen worse. And the end of this match scared the shit out of me, because the match ended on a double countout, which is always a terrible finish. But Mabel went to clothesline Bam Bam Bigelow out of the ring at the end of this match. And what ended up happening was Mabel. Now, remember, keep in mind, Mabel is a huge man. And he was part of Men on a Mission at this point. He was wearing the big baggy pajamas and weighed in excess of 500 pounds easily. And Mabel comes at Bam Bam in this match and gives him a cactus clothesline. I don't think it was intended that way. But Mabel just, I can't even say it was a cactus clothesline, because the way that Foley used to do that clothesline is he would jump at you, clothesline you, and his body would do a complete rotation over the top rope, and he would fall out of the ring with you. This was more a situation where Mabel probably just couldn't, with his massive girth, he probably just couldn't keep himself from falling out of the ring, and he just sunk like a stone. I mean, he just fell out of the ring. I thought he fell on his head. It was a scary moment, and the match ended that way. Probably for the better, actually, because you really can't top that. That was probably the highlight of the entire match. As a match, it sucked, but again, I've seen worse. And what came next was, you can make an argument for the best match on this tape. It was up there with the Shawn Razor match. It was the Head Shrinkers and the Quebecers. And clearly this match was done at a Raw taping, and a lot of times back then they would tape matches at a Monday Night Raw taping, or a taping of Challenge, or Superstars, and it wasn't a match that aired on those shows, it was just done at the same TV taping for the videotape. So I just watched this match and assumed, okay, I see that there's the Monday Night Raw banner, but this probably was just taped for Coliseum Video. This match, I assume, must have aired on TV, because it turned out to be the Head Shrinkers title change. This was the one time the Head Shrinkers won the WWF Tag Team titles. I did not know for sure that they were winning the championships in this match. And so when they actually won them, imagine my surprise. I'm watching this and I see a title change. This was a great tag team match. It really was. And I don't know if I'm just saying that because my standards for tag team wrestling in 2011 are so goddamn low. But I think as a traditional wrestling tag team match, this was fine. I thought the Head Shrinkers were a very good tag team, and I thought the Quebecers were always very underrated. Jacques Rougeau is a great wrestler. Pierre, back then, he was a little bit heftier, but he was also, in his prime, I guess you would say. And the thing I loved about the Quebecers was they were a true tag team. They actually did tandem tag team offense. So, for example, they were known for doing moves where Jacques would pick up Pierre and slam him down onto his opponents. He would basically execute moves on his own tag team partner, but for the good of the team, because he would slam Pierre down onto their adversary. He would do something where Pierre would run into the ropes and Jacques would give him a back body drop, and Pierre and his massive girth would land on top of the other person. I like that. We don't see enough of that, I think, or hardly any of that, really. Certainly not in WWE. And they had a fine match. You know, there was nothing wrong with it. I did kept asking myself, why did the Head Shrinkers ever need two managers? Because, you know, they had Afa, the Wild Samoan, who was part of the original Wild Samoans tag team back in the 70s. And Afa was their manager from the day they came into the WWF. And then they did this angle where they brought back Captain Lou Albano. Talk about a relic from the past. And they brought him back to be a manager also of sorts for the Head Shrinkers. I guess the idea was that Albano could be a mouthpiece for them because Afa didn't really do promos. So I guess in that respect it makes sense, but it just looks stupid seeing both guys at ringside managing the Head Shrinkers. So I like this match a lot. The tag team title change at the end, it was just done very well. The crowd was going crazy. They had a moment in this match early on where the Head Shrinkers were in the ring. The Quebecers were walking out. They left. They went to the back. And the referee told Howard Finkel to make the announcement that if the Quebecers do not return to the ring by the count of 10, they will lose the championships. And I always laughed because I said, since when does the referee have the authority to make that kind of change? You know, if this happened today, the referees now, they're so castrated compared to the way they used to be. You can't make a decision like that. You'd have to have, you know, John Laryngitis come out to make a decision, or whoever the general manager flavor of the month is. So I like this match a lot. One of my favorite matches on the entire tape. Conversely, we then had Atom Bomb and Earthquake. Atom Bomb and Earthquake had a match, or they were supposed to have a match, at WrestleMania 10. And they did have a match, but it was a 30-second squash of Earthquake pinning Atom Bomb. And the reason that the match went so short was because they were running low on time. So I guess this was the big rematch that they didn't have a chance to do at WrestleMania. And having watched the match, I can say that WrestleMania 10 was much better for having a 30-second Atom Bomb Earthquake match than what we had on this tape. This match was pretty shitty. Let's just put it that way. It was no good. And Earthquake won clean. He just beat Atom Bomb like a job guy. And that was that. Not really much to talk about there. We had Bret Hart, weeks after winning the WWF Championship at WrestleMania, defending against Quang. For those of you who are wondering, Quang, the martial art expert Quang, was played by Savio Vega. And, whatever, it was a basic match. I was never really a big fan of Vega from his Quang days. And Bret Hart beat him with a sharpshooter, as he should have. He is the WWF champion, after all. So there you go. Quebecers and Jeff Jarrett in a six-man tag against Men on a Mission and Doink the Clown. As I said, I watched this entire tape, and this match was no exception. And I will say this. Doink the Clown got his ass kicked in this match. I mean, he just got the shit kicked out of him in what felt like forever. And Men on a Mission, they're just standing out there letting this poor bastard get his ass kicked. And it just seemed to never end. It just went on and on and on and on. And he tried to make a tag at one point, and the heels cut him off. And it just continued on, and he would be thrown into the ropes, and they would do a move. And they were trying to kill the clown is what they were doing here. And then, of course, at the end, Mabel gets tagged in. He's in the ring for like a minute, and he wins the match. And all I could think is, this poor fucker laying on the ground here, he's just been completely destroyed, only for these guys to tag in 2 minutes of work, and the match is over. So there you go. Randy Savage and Lex Luger, tag team match against Yokozuna and Crush. Yokozuna was so intense and serious about this match that he was chewing gum the entire time. And this may have been one of the worst matches on the entire tape, believe it or not. Savage looked really old. He actually limped out to the ring, and I don't know if he was actually hurt. My guess is he was selling some sort of leg injury. From what I don't know, Savage was not doing a lot of wrestling back in 94, and I don't remember his leg being worked on at WrestleMania in the match with Crush, so I don't know what the hell he was selling or if he was really hurt. But he looked really, really old in this match. And Luger was Luger. You know, you get what you get with him. And nothing special at all. Savage and Luger won the match. I think, if I remember correctly, I don't remember who it was, if it was Luger or Savage, but somebody stole Yokozuna's rice bucket, his wooden rice bucket, and I think whacked Crush in the head with it and pinned him, and that was pretty much it. So there you go. And then the last match was The Undertaker and Crush. Got a lot of Crush on this tape. At least it felt that way. I guess he was only in two matches. But this match was pretty awful. Really, any Undertaker match, I think, before... I don't know. I'd say probably any Undertaker match before 96 sucked. Undertaker did not have a lot of good matches in the early days. And it wasn't always his fault. I mean, it was partially his fault. He would get better over time, but a lot of it had to do with the people they put him in the ring with. I mean, look at the people that Undertaker had to feud with when, you know, when he first came in, he wrestled Hogan and Warrior and all that, but look at the feuds that he had. I mean, he feuded with the Giant Gonzalez, for crying out loud. Yokozuna, who I thought as a big man performer was very good and very agile until he let his weight just completely spiral out of control. But, you know, Kama... Crush in this match. He's having a match with Crush. He feuded with, who else did he feud with? King Kong Bundy. This guy had nothing to work with, just nothing. And this match was pretty bad. Undertaker gave him a tombstone at the end, and that was it. Pinned him 1-2-3. The match ends, the tape ends with an Undertaker match, which made sense. Paul Bearer basically, in between all the different matches that he would introduce in the video, he was walking through some sort of theater, some old theater. He was in, like, the bowels of the building, and then he's sitting in the theater, which looked an awful lot to me like the Manhattan Center, where they used to tape Monday Night Raw. I'm not sure if it was. I'm just saying it looked a lot like the Manhattan Center. And that was it. That was Paul Bearer's Hits from the Crypt. If you're going to get the video, and I don't know how you would do that unless you watched it on demand, I guess you can go on eBay or something, and they have wrestling tape trading sites. I wouldn't put all that effort in to go seek this tape out. It's not really worth it, but if you happen to get your hands on it, or if you have WWE Classics and you want to watch it, watch the Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon match and watch the Head Shrinkers Tag Team title change. The rest is pretty much a waste. So, there you go. Before we get to your questions, I just want to give a quick shout-out to one of the listeners of our show, Madison J. You can check out his website at rapslikewrestling.tumblr.com. That's rapslikewrestling.tumblr.com. He is, I guess, the wrestling rapper, you can call him. He's got some interesting stuff up there on his Tumblr page, including a song that he put together called Red and Yellow, which I guess is a tribute to the Hulkster. And it's kind of a play off that Wiz Khalifa song, Black and Yellow, which I know people hate. I actually like it, but it's Red and Yellow, not Black and Yellow, and it's very clever. So you can check that out and a lot of other stuff on his page. And also, don't forget to check out the SE Scoops mailbag, which went up on the main page on Friday, I believe. Either Thursday or Friday. I think Friday. So, check out that mailbag if you missed it. We've already got a ton of comments underneath it. And the question was, one of the main questions, what is the absolute worst chant in wrestling history? Well, it wasn't the question, but that's basically how I answered that particular question. I think many of you could figure out what chant I'm talking about. So, check out that mailbag if you have questions that you would like to see appear on the main page in that particular mailbag. Send those questions in to seScoops@gmail.com. We need more questions, so send them in to seScoops@gmail.com. As for the Sound Off mailbag, all questions for that one go directly to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. And on that note, let's take some of your questions here. Tony had wrote in and emailed me with a suggested list that he would like to see of WWE pay-per-views as far as how they do their schedule and everything. And I responded basically by saying the way I would do it is I would have Royal Rumble in January. You have WrestleMania in March or April. You know, you keep that the way it is. Bring back King of the Ring. Put that in June. You have SummerSlam in August. And you have the Survivor Series in November with War Games. I've said for a long time now that War Games should be a gimmick that is used as part of the Survivor Series. I mean, even the name makes sense. War Games at Survivor Series. It just it sells itself. And, you know, War Games at Survivor Series would eliminate the need for the Elimination Chamber and the other gimmicks like Hell in a Cell and TLC, which can go back to being the novelty that they should be. And maybe you do them once a year. And you could have a Night of Champions or something like the old Cyber Sunday show with fan voting, which you can use as a special attraction on NBC or USA during the months where there is a long build to one of the pay-per-views. So, for example, on the road to WrestleMania. And I've talked in the past about having pre- and post-game shows for the pay-per-views, which I still think is something they should look into. And Tony wanted to know a little bit more about War Games. I guess he wasn't a fan back in the day, at least not of WCW, so he's not as familiar with the concept. And basically what War Games is, yes, it was a WCW concept, by the way, and started actually even in the old NWA days. I think the first War Games may have been back around 86 or so. I could be off on that. I have to go look it up. But basically, it wasn't anything overly special except that you had two wrestling rings instead of one. And both rings were encased in basically the Hell in a Cell structure. It was a topped-off mesh fence steel cage that had no wall in the middle dividing the two rings. So it was just two rings topped off by a giant steel cage. And you would have two people start the match off, and then I think it would switch off based on whether you were on the heels or the faces. It would alternate, almost like a Royal Rumble. You would have intervals where people would then enter the cage. So you could have a situation where it's, you know, two-on-one or something like that until the next person comes in. And actually, I could be wrong. Maybe it was a coin toss or something. It wasn't necessarily that it went back and forth. It's been a long time, actually, since I've seen a War Games match, so I forget. But it was just, you know, you talk about a match that has a lot of carnage and just, it looks different. You know, we've never seen WWE do a match where they have not one but two rings. And I can see why they wouldn't want to do that logistically. You basically would be wiping out a lot of extra ringside seats that you can make money off of. But I still think as a once-a-year gimmick at a pay-per-view like Survivor Series, it would work phenomenally well. But then again, you know what? In 2011, in modern-day WWE, you know what? War Games probably wouldn't work because WWE is PG, and War Games is another one of those matches where you don't need blood. I don't think every War Games match always had blood. But blood, I think, would be an important part of it. You know, it's called War Games for a reason. You know, you're going in there not to have tea time with Santino. But to me, I just don't understand why Vince McMahon is so bullheaded that he just outright refused to bring War Games over as a concept when they bought WCW. Triple H, old school wrestling guy, he supposedly tried to convince Vince McMahon back then to do a War Games match, and Vince just said no, and we ended up with the Elimination Chamber. Kenneth writes in, wants to know about wrestling documentaries. He actually wanted to know the name of the documentary that featured Colt Cabana and Bryan Danielson. He says, I know you've brought it up a few times lately and wanted to check it out. That would be the Wrestling Road Diaries. I finally finished it about a month and a half ago or so, and it took me a while. It is a long documentary. I mean, I think it's in excess of 2 hours. I mean, it's pretty long, but it's very well done. And if you want to get to know more about Daniel Bryan, for those of you who only know him from WWE, this is a good opportunity to get to know a little bit more about him. The guy has a lot more personality than they would let you believe on TV. And certainly Michael Cole out there calling him boring all the time, he's anything but boring. So check that one out. His second question here, he's heard of a wrestling documentary called The Princess Diaries or something like that. What is it exactly? When was it made? Maybe I'm just mistaken. I believe you are mistaken, my friend. I think you're thinking of the Disney movie, The Princess Diaries. There's definitely no wrestling documentary that I'm aware of by that name. If there is, I would not care to watch it. Greg V. writes in, hey, Solomonster, I recently started calling John Laurinaitis laryngitis, thinking that I was the only one. That is, until Sound Off 184, when you started doing the same thing. I guess great minds think alike. However, as is customary in WWE nowadays, I must inform you that I have filed a lawsuit against you regarding the situation. Anyway, keep up the good work. I look forward to your podcast every week. I'm not worried, because if it's anything like WWE, this lawsuit will be dropped and forgotten about within 2 weeks. GNet614, if that is your real name, writes in, big fan of the Sound Off, share a lot of the similar views. Not here to ask questions, but to make a new friend in the wrestling world. And if you are interested, I work for Warriors of Wrestling. If you'd like to check out a show soon, we'd love to hear a Sound Off. A Sound Off? Really? This is didn't know this was the Sound Off. Would love to hear a Sound Off shout-out. There we go, for WOW. I looked at that. I glanced at that when I first opened the email. I thought you were talking about World of Warcraft, which I refuse to play, by the way, because I've heard of way too many people getting addicted to that game. But anyway, Warriors of Wrestling. Yes, I was not aware of it. I checked out the website. It looks very interesting. And if anybody else out there would like to check them out, you could do a Google search. It'll be one of the first things that comes up. Warriors of Wrestling. So there you go. Let's take two questions here from Luis from Illinois. Number one, do you think The Rock will insist that JR call his WrestleMania match? Very good question. I would have to think that he would. You know, this is going to be Rock's, well, obviously now it's not going to be Rock's first match back, but it'll be Rock's first singles match in a WWE ring in many, many years. And many people know the story behind JR's comeback to the announce booth at WrestleMania 15 back in 1999. He had been out after suffering another bout of Bell's palsy. He was doing, at that time, the whole JR, you know, heel storyline, which was quickly dropped. And both Austin and Rock went to Vince McMahon to plead their case at WrestleMania before the show that JR should call the main event. And lo and behold, it was Michael Cole who called pretty much the entire show. And then before the main event, Michael Cole got up and left the announce booth, and Jim Ross took his place. And my, oh my, what I wouldn't give for a repeat of that all these years later. But I would have to think The Rock would at least talk to Vince about it. I'm not saying he's going to be able to change Vince's mind, but I would expect that he would probably at least make an attempt. Second question here. Other than Shawn Michaels with Hulk Hogan at SummerSlam 2005 and Steven Regal, now William Regal, with Bill Goldberg in WCW, can you think of any other instances of a more experienced worker purposely making his opponent look bad? Absolutely. Go take a look at any Triple H match from the early 2000s during his reign of terror when he was in the ring with guys like Booker T and Rob Van Dam and Scott Steiner. By the way, James Tingstrom, your email account appears to have been hacked or taken over by somebody else. I've gotten a couple of spam messages from you already, so you might want to get that checked out and fixed. Marcus from California writes in, love the show, member of the Fantastic Four. How bad of an effect do you think it would cause if the Muppets appearance was the week right after the episode we had this week? Although a lot of things could be better than this week's show. Honestly, after this week's show, I'm looking forward to the Muppets appearance. It cannot possibly be any worse than what we saw this week on Raw. I say bring them on. They may actually improve the show. I think we have a Muppet running the company right now, or at least we have a bunch of puppets that work for the person who runs WWE right now. Andre Richardson writes in, I just finished watching Impact, and I gotta say I'm shocked. The show was good and well-written, because I'm really shocked at how TNA handled its go-home pay-per-view show. I'd recommend that you watch it. I also think the way they promoted the Kurt Angle-Bobby Roode match was very well done. I hate to say it, because I look at TNA as nothing but a joke, but I'm looking forward to how Roode and Kurt have their match play out at the pay-per-view. TNA pushed the main event real well, and I wish WWE did this more for its main events. Because for some reason, I feel the TNA title is more important than the WWE Championship, all from the hype based on this match. You know what? I will say this, and I haven't even seen a lot of Impact. I've seen clips that people have recommended I watch of the Roode-Kurt stuff, and I will say this. The TNA World Championship, as of right now, heading into Bound for Glory, is more valuable than the WWE Championship. And that is something I never thought I would say. But absolutely, the TNA title does have more value right now. It does have more prestige. It does seem like something worth fighting for. The WWE Championship is a joke. It gets treated like a joke. Its champion gets treated like a joke. It changes so many times, it can't possibly mean anything of any value to anybody. Got a letter here from Rob from Poole on the south coast of England. First, wanted to thank you for the weekly eargasm. Keep up the great work. I was just thinking about the what chance during the promos on Raw and SmackDown. And would you agree that the crowd doesn't give the wrestler a chance to cut a good promo before tearing into them with what chance? I know some of the wrestlers have overcome them by talking lower and slower, but do you agree that it probably gets to most of the wrestlers and puts them off? Check out the main page mailbag on SEScoops.com, because I answer a question about this. And I will say that on Raw last Monday, there wasn't a whole lot to like, but I did love the hell out of what Vince McMahon did when he came out. Vince McMahon came to the ring, and he started to get the what chance himself, but what Vince does, and Vince doesn't, he doesn't talk too fast. You don't have to talk like a bullet train, but he was talking almost without taking a breath, and he did not give these people a chance. He did not give them a chance in hell of interrupting him with those what chants. Chris Jericho was great at that. When he went heel and he was wearing the suit and he was coming out every week and using all these big words and cutting these very serious promos in that low voice. First of all, talking low is an old trick that Jake the Snake Roberts used to use. It forces people to pay more attention to your promo. So, for example, if you've got two wrestlers, one of whom does nothing but scream, okay, take Psycho Sid. Psycho Sid could talk low and then all of a sudden out of nowhere he would scream. And take a guy like Jake the Snake, and you put them side by side and have them cut a serious promo, are you going to pay more attention to the guy that's screaming at the top of his lungs, or are you going to pay closer attention to the guy like Jake Roberts, who's talking very low, he's staring right at you? You're going to pay attention to every little detail that this guy says. You're going to hang on his every word, because you have to work harder, first of all, to pay attention, because he is talking lower. And he just cuts a better promo, so that's probably a horrible example to give. But Jericho was the master of that. People did not want him at all, and if they started to, it would quickly fizzle out because he wouldn't give them an opportunity to interrupt him. And then you have people like Mark Henry who could learn a thing or two from them. Mark Henry goes out there, and the substance of Mark Henry's promos of late has been great, but he makes one very cardinal mistake, and he doesn't do it on purpose. Like R-Truth, for example, it's become part of his gimmick, okay? He plays into the what chance. For him, that's fine. Mark Henry does not go out there with the intention or the expectation of being interrupted and kind of caught off guard by what chance. He allows it to happen. It's his own fault because he talks in sentence fragments. Who talks like that in real life, okay? I'm not talking in sentence fragments right now. I'm talking like a normal person. But Mark Henry goes out there and he says, Randy Orton, and then he'll stop. This Sunday, and then he'll stop. And of course, people take that to mean, oh, okay, I'll interrupt with a what chant here and a what chant there. And before you know it, the whole promo is completely ruined and drowned out by these fucking chants. And I don't know why they allow it to happen. Mark Henry, he's just begging for people to what him to death when he goes out there and he does that. And it just annoys the shit out of me. Randy Orton, by the way, talks like that too, but he has the benefit of being one of the biggest baby faces in the company, so people don't what him. What? I said people don't what him. You see, that was pretty annoying, wasn't it? Here's another email. Hey, Solomonster, you said you were going to watch and break down any match we want as long as you can find it. Please break down the Bret Hart vs. Ric Flair match from Saskatoon, where Bret won his first WWE Championship title. That comes from Scott. I'll give you one guess where Scott comes from. Scott from Saskatoon. Who'd have thunk it? So I'll add that match to my list. It was a pretty good match, too. I know Ric Flair, I think, maybe in his book, actually, talked about the match being a pile of shit, but I thought it was a pretty good match. Bill Mitchell writes in, what is with all the Mark Henry and Randy Orton matches? Just when you thought that feud was put to rest and Mark Henry looks on to the big show, here we are again with yet another Randy Orton versus Mark Henry World Heavyweight Championship match. Of course, this is from SmackDown, which I didn't mention earlier. Randy Orton won a 41-man Battle Royal to get a championship match on the same show against Mark Henry. And anyway, he's wondering, is Randy somewhat being punished, perhaps, by WWE executives for the comments that he made talking about the one person he hates to get in the ring with as being Mark Henry? He made those comments, if you remember, on the same interview where he insinuated that Kelly has slept with a number of WWE talents. I know this wouldn't qualify as, quote, a burial per se, but is this another way WWE likes to make examples out of their superstars? I don't think that has anything to do with it at all. WWE does this with everybody. They take a match and they beat it into the ground until it doesn't mean anything anymore. And I think part of what their reasoning here is, they're furthering the Randy Orton-Cody Rhodes feud by having Cody constantly cost Orton the championship. And so there is some sense of logic to it, although I wouldn't necessarily do it this way. There's other ways to build heat between Orton and Cody. And, drawing more on their legacy past, for example. I could see the two of them have a great in-ring promo segment back and forth. But, you know, then again, Randy Orton isn't a great promo, and Cody Rhodes sucks on the microphone because they don't let him talk like a normal person. He talks like a wildebeest or something. So I think that's their logic behind it. Orton is not being punished at all. Orton is rarely, if ever, punished by the company. He may get admonished every now and then if he says something, but I can't remember the last time Randy Orton was actually punished. And anyway, Bill says, for the love of God, someone please tell Michael Cole that Meet the Press is the longest running episodic show in history. I am so sick of that damn statistic. I don't know if Meet the Press would qualify as a episodic television. I think certainly by their definition of episodic it wouldn't, but absolutely. I mean, there's actually more shows even than that. I talked about this once before. I'd have to go back and look it up. But there are other shows that have been on television longer. But again, technically they're not incorrect because to them they use very particular language when they claim these things. So I'm sure that if you went to them and said that again, they would say, well, Meet the Press is not episodic television. That's more of a political show. That's a talk show. That's not what we do. We're here to entertain people, which is another debatable point. Kirk writes in with an interesting point. I noticed that when Alberto Del Rio and Ricardo Rodriguez were leaving SmackDown that Teddy Long ordered him to face Sheamus. If Del Rio is a Raw superstar, why the fuck would he have to do what Teddy Long tells him to do? Just another shitty example of WWE writing. Chance from Jersey City, New Jersey writes in, just passing along some information about the apparent closing of the Ace Arena in Union City, New Jersey. For listeners who don't know, the Ace Arena was a small venue that housed many independent promotions, including Evolve, Dragon Gate USA, and Women's Wrestling Uncensored. The arena has or rather was, a promoter's dream, in that the house provided its own ring, folding chairs, entrance ramps, and guardrails. Also a factor was that it was only minutes away from the Lincoln Tunnel for New York fans, within walking distance from many restaurants and diners, and had tons of free street parking for all. Personally, I will miss the Ace Arena for the simple fact that it was within 5 minutes driving distance from my home. I'll also miss chances to meet and greet wrestlers like Bryan Danielson and Austin Aries, as they were amongst many others that have battled in the Ace Arena. Not to mention, one of the best hardcore matches I've ever seen live took place in that building. Homicide against Jon Moxley, who of course is now Dean Ambrose down in FCW. As a matter of fact, just a little sidebar here. Moxley just had a match down at FCW with William Regal that I heard was pretty good. So if anybody happens to come across that match, if it's uploaded to YouTube somewhere, post a link on my Facebook and let everybody know, because I'd be curious to check that match out. But anyway, Chance continues here. He says, "There's no doubt in my mind when WWE signed Moxley, his promo work for this match was a huge factor. The only updates that have been passed along is that many promoters have found other venues to hold their events. Evolve 10 is put on hiatus, and that arena is officially closed because the moron who owns it didn't pay his property taxes to the city. Very sad loss for the wrestling in DC." Well, when you don't pay your taxes, that's what's going to happen. So, that's sad to hear. Lude writes in, "I was sitting here reading Hulk Hogan's tweet about Marx, not recognizing the difference between when someone, quote, works a work and works their way into a shoot, or is legitimately shooting. I'm assuming he's referring to the comments he made about Bobby Roode. Do you think this is an accurate statement from Hogan? Do you think that even the most devoted wrestling fan still stops a work too late and gets hyped into controversy? I've seen that more than a few people are upset with Hogan's comments about Roode, but could it be that Hogan understands business past wrestling and uses those talents to draw up controversy, and it works?" Well, let me ask you a question. If that's the case, what exactly is gained by, again, burying the guy that the company that you work for is trying to put over and claiming that, well, I would go with somebody else, I wouldn't go with this guy? What sort of controversy is that really creating? Again, if Hogan would have said, listen, if he would have said all the things he said about Bobby Roode, as I said earlier, and put over Kurt Angle and said, Kurt's going to mop the floor with this guy, this kid's not ready, he doesn't know what he's in for, he's in way over his head, that would be one thing. But the fact that, again, he went and made the comments he made about James Storm, who is a babyface. So what sense does it make if Hogan's going to put down one babyface if he's, quote, in character, and then put another one over? You know, unless, again, they're going with an angle where James Storm tonight at the pay-per-view goes heel and turns on his tag team partner and joins Immortal. Then I suppose it would make sense. But otherwise, it doesn't make sense. What controversy are you creating? You know, Eric Bischoff's book was called Controversy Creates Cash, or something like that. What cash is being generated by this so-called controversy? This is not a controversy. This was stupid comments made by Hulk Hogan, which would not be the first time that's happened. If this controversy led to them making money, then I would say, okay, I'm wrong. But this is not going to make them any money. This is going to make them look stupid. This is going to make people think, oh, yeah, people who don't know any better, maybe they're former wrestling fans, or they're just Hulk Hogan fans. They know who Hogan is, and they said, oh, Hogan's working for this wrestling company, and he's talking about some young guy that I don't even know about, and he's telling me that this guy isn't any good. That really accomplishes a lot. Blackleg from the Philippines writes in, "Not so long ago, I heard a rumor that there's a prevailing sentiment among top men in the WWE that Vince McMahon would choose to kill the company rather than watch it flourish under someone else. I know the man is an egomaniacal control freak, but I don't even think he would go that far. However, after the debauchery that was last week's show, the Rush storylines, which, as you said, is a common theme for them this year, the burial of talent, and all the crazy last-minute rewrites, I'm starting to believe that sentiment to be true. What do you think? As always, keep up the good work. I'm sure even the board of directors thinks you're doing a good job." Well, I hope so. I wouldn't want them to relieve me of my duties, even though you know that if they did, I'd be back in 6 weeks. What do I think? I don't think he... Look, his family is taking the company over when he's done. His daughter, his son-in-law. If it was somebody else, I wouldn't rule it out, because there are some people who think like that. They think, well, if I can't have it, nobody can. It's like an obsessed boyfriend. Only in this case, the boyfriend isn't obsessed. The boyfriend is suffering from early-onset dementia. I shouldn't even say that, because Vince is already in his mid-60s. It wouldn't exactly be early. He may well be suffering from dementia. You know, he is at that age. He is showing the signs of wear and tear. He is a workaholic. He barely gets any sleep. I've heard people say that Vince McMahon hates sleeping almost as much as he hates sneezing. He gets barely 4 hours of sleep a night, and sometimes he won't get any sleep throughout the week, and then at the end of the week, he'll try to compensate for that by sleeping for like a day straight or a day and a half straight. That doesn't work. You know, when you lose sleep, you cannot get that sleep back. There's no such thing as making up for lost sleep. You know, if I had a really rough week and I slept 2 hours every night and I can barely keep my eyes open at the end of the week, and so I say, okay, this weekend I'm going to catch up on some sleep. I'm going to sleep for like 12 hours straight, and then the next day I'm going to sleep for like 15 hours straight. First of all, you can't do that. When you plan on sleeping that long, it's impossible to do it. And number two, you can sleep for 15 hours, but you've already lost valuable sleep that you can't get back. And just imagine the work schedule that Vince McMahon keeps up. He doesn't take a vacation. You know, if nothing else, I respect his work ethic, but he just takes it way too far. And I think that has more to do with it than anything else. The fact that his daughter is taking over the company with his son-in-law, why would he want to sabotage them? I don't buy into that at all. Last question here from Casey Collins, who writes in, I just watched a few episodes of the Legends Roundtable on YouTube. I was wondering how to get it on TV and would it be worth it? The only way to get it on TV is if you have access to WWE's Classics On Demand service in your area, and that's going to depend on your cable company. I don't know where you live. I said earlier, here in New York, I have access to it through Cablevision, but the biggest cable provider in New York City is Time Warner, and after all these years, they still don't offer the service. So it really does depend on where you live. Like I said, I personally think it's worth it. You know, if you are a fan of classic wrestling, whether it's WWE or not, because they offer you, you know, WCW content, ECW content, World Class content, AWA content, Stampede, maybe not every month. But you do have a sampling of a little bit of everything. The Legends Roundtables are an exclusive part of that service. Now, you know, you can wait. I'm sure they'll pop up on YouTube at some point. But they are well worth it. They are absolutely well worth it. In fact, I believe they released the Legends Roundtable DVD not too long ago, or they may be working on another one. And they're one of the few original features, part of the Classics On Demand service, that I think is better, quite frankly, than anything that WWE is putting out on TV today. I think those Legends Roundtables could easily be a USA Network show. It'd have to be edited down, because a lot of them tend to go in excess of an hour. You know, some of them can be 79 minutes or something like that. But it's absolutely worth it. I highly recommend it. Going to wrap up the mailbag for this week. Keep sending in those questions. Again, thesolomonster@gmail.com comes to me directly. If you have questions for the main page, SE Scoops mailbag, and we definitely need more questions for that, send those to seScoops@gmail.com. But again, remember, for this show, it goes to the other address. And you can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster. We are on the cusp of 1,100 followers, so hopefully you are among them. Friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolomonster. We're also always adding new friends, and want you to be part of that community as well. If we do a Facebook-only mailbag thread, which we may be doing sometime in the next few weeks, you will have to be a Facebook friend in order to participate and submit your question, so that's reason enough to get on Facebook, even if you hate Facebook. Just make me your only friend. You don't have to friend anybody else. Friend me. Don't you want to be my friend? And you could also subscribe to the YouTube channel. My username on there is TheSolomonster, all one word. I just put episode 182 up last week, which was the interview I did with George Napolitano. I'm planning on putting 184 up shortly, most likely, which was my Raw rant from earlier in the week, which, again, if you haven't checked it out, you could go back and download it. I think you'll enjoy it. And quite frankly, I think you'll agree with most everything I had to say. And subscribe to the show on iTunes. It's totally free. You type in Solomonster Sounds Off, and the show will automatically be downloaded for you. And if you go through Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and YouTube, yes, you are in fact part of the Fantastic Four, although there is certainly no shame in being part of the Triple Threat, still a very elite group. But there really is no reason for you to be a single swinger or a member of the Double Trouble or whatever you guys were calling it. You guys have some pretty creative names. So hit me up any of those ways. Thank you, as always, for supporting the show. Without your support, there would be no Sound Off. And we're actually approaching the four-year anniversary of this show in less than a month. Can you believe that? I think it's like the first week or something of November is going to be our four-year anniversary show. And I can't believe it's been that long. Time truly does fly when you're having fun. And I look forward to four more years and all that. So that'll be a fun show coming up in the next couple of weeks. I've got some other things in the pipeline I think you may find fun as well that I'm working on. So until next week, episode 186, be well, stay safe, enjoy Bound for Glory. If you are checking out the pay-per-view, let me know what you think. And we'll be right back here next week on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.